Okay, good evening and welcome to the Harvard District Board meeting. And we are here on August 13th, and we're going to open the regular session right here at straight up six. So here we go. Stephen Coleman is with us online. We went through a special process to allow him to participate online. So you'll see him up on the screen. Good evening, President Coleman. We've started session, and so we do have a quorum, and we can take actions tonight, as sparse as we appear to be. So welcome to everyone, and let's start with the pledge.
Can I do a roll call first?
Oh, sorry, we got to do a roll call. Thanks. All right,
no problem.
They're gonna keep me straight here.
Sorry, Commissioner Norton,
present.
Commissioner Coleman.
Mute. We can't hear you.
Commissioner Coleman, unmute yourself just to say that you're here.
There, now, yeah, Mindy needed to allow me to unmute. So, yes, I am here remotely. Thank you.
Commissioner Benson?
I'm here.
Commissioner Dale? And Commissioner Newman?
We have a quorum.
Okay, so now we can do the Pledge of Allegiance. All right.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Council, Ryan Plotz, do we have any reportable action from our closed session?
Yes, we do. During tonight's closed session, the council or the commission met to consider the appointment of special counsel, and the commission voted 3-0 to approve the appointment of the law firm Stoll Reeves to serve as special counsel with respect to permitting an environmental review associated with the heavy lift multipurpose marine terminal project. And that authorization was given to Executive Director Mickelson to go ahead and sign the engagement, which would then make it a public record and can be produced to the public.
Thank you. Thank you much. Okay, let's move now to item 7. It's public comment. So this is the opportunity for anyone in the house, in the chambers, or online. And we'll start within the chambers first to make comment on any topic that you think is germane to the commission that is not on tonight's agenda, that we won't speak about, tonight on the regular agenda. We have someone. Okay, just come on up. Tell us your name and give us your.
Yeah. Hi, my name's Rod Gonzalez. I'm a resident of Samoa. There was a point where this project is, I'm on Bayview. It's right in front of my house. And there was a time where I was thinking, well, this would be pretty cool to have, 10 years from now, I'll be 70. I'll see a guy on a windmill that looks like an ant, and I'd probably enjoy that, But what I started to really realize is from now until 70, I'm going to have to deal with health issues, noise issues. I'm a sailor. I'm starting to do some looking at these windmills on the wet storage site, and the channel that's going in there. I believe it's taking my recreational area from sailing, as well as other people. I sail in there once a week, and I wasn't the guy that got grounded there. That wasn't me last week. Okay. But, and then I started to realize that, I'm not going to see the sunrise anymore like I used to, and now a shadow is going to be cast on my house. I'm starting to worry now, I've been in the indoor air quality, for 40 years. And so I know what dust and bad air and air in my house is going to cause me. It's going to affect my health. Then I start putting myself aside, and I'm looking at the other residents. They're going through that same thing, and then I look up the peninsula where the townhomes are, which is low income. I came from low income, so I know that I've gotten squashed. I've watched people ran over low income people, and they're the ones that seem to don't have a word, and when I look at this council, and all I can ask you guys is really consider putting this somewhere else, and I know that's a laugh and a joke, but really, I mean, in the end, when you think about it, when we pass, we're going to leave a leg. We love to leave a legacy. Might be a plaque. It might be something that everybody's saying great about everybody, right? But the truth is, if it affects people's lives and their health, that plaque is going to get it's the varnish is going to rub off. Okay, it's not going to shine anymore, and people are going to remember that. People that voted for this might have made the wrong decision. And I challenged this to your members, and I challenged it to myself as well. So I don't want anybody to get offended by it. But right now, currently, do all the board members have solar on their house? 100%. Do you have heat pumps? Do you have are you burning fossil fuel? And are you riding a horse to work? So, and what I mean by that, if your cause is to, and I agree, we need this. I understand. We got a huge crunch. We got a population that's just going to keep growing. We're going to have a major problem. But why stomp on people that live in this little town? This thing's going to be in front of their house. I don't agree with it anymore. I just don't. And I hope that I can keep coming here until the day I have the last few minutes that I have to keep convincing you that put yourself in my shoes, in our shoes that live there, and ask yourself, would you want this in front of your house? So
Thank you.
thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay. Good. Before we have the next speaker, I just want to check in with council. Under unfinished business, we're having an update on the heavy lift marine terminal. So is it so
That would be the time.
that would be the time to make comments around this.
And that's
Yeah.
fine.
Yeah. So we do have an agenda item to talk about the heavy lift marine terminal. So I'm looking for other issues that you may want to bring up that are not represented in tonight's agenda. Any other announcements?
Hello, Sebastian Allwright. Humboldt Bay Provisions, Aqua Rodeo Farms, and Humboldt Bay Oyster Tours. I just wanted to talk a little bit maybe about the one of the stools of this, or stools, one of the legs on the stool of this project. More about the overland part currently, how it's set up, that we only have two 115 kilovolt lines going east from here. And then, if this project continues as proposed through the overland process, they're going to add a substation over next to freshwater.
Sorry, Ryan, I have to. I need to stop you just so that everyone in the house is clear. This is for public comment on any items that are not on the agenda. We have heavy lift marine terminal on the
But I'm
agenda.
not talking about the heavy lift
So
marine.
you're talking about the transmission lines?
Yeah.
Okay,
Is that
closely related.
closely related? Right. It's
Okay.
one of the stools legs that you had mentioned
Okay. Fair
about
enough.
the entire project, but it's not necessarily
I
for the.
understand now, and I'm sorry to have stopped you. Go continue, please, and we'll re-give you that time.
Currently, I'm sure you're aware of a lot of developments through technology that a lot of pushback on the data centers and some of those kind of things. And I believe that this project is mostly to facilitate that type of thing, especially in regards to what kind of energy demands we have here locally. So with some of the more recent developments about some of the nuclear stuff that's going on with the small reactors that they're trying to put together to go to the moon, I think that probably in 5 to 10 years, this project won't really be as necessary as we deem it right now with that nuclear energy coming online. That's probably a lot more feasible directly into the data centers and also without long needs for transmission lines or anything like that, because they'll just put it right next to where they actually need and want the power. Another thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was the
the cultural presence of aquaculture in Humboldt Bay. I've been farming oysters on Humboldt Bay since 1992, and I know that commercial aquaculture operations in Humboldt Bay started in the mid-50s, so that's probably about 80 years ago or so. And I can't tell you how many times I've been peddling my oysters on the bay or even around Northern California at various farmers markets and things like that. And I have countless numbers of people who come up to me and talk to me about how they had their grandmother who used to wear a hairnet and shuck oysters at Coast Seafood in Eureka, or how they remember as a kid they would go out to the beds in the canoes after a good brant hunt and feast on some oysters. And I just don't want to see any of that go away for future generations if something were to go awry with some of the things going on with proposed projects affecting the bay and the potential natural resources that are here for the current cultural and past cultural uses. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments for items not on tonight's agenda? How about online? Are there any hands raised? Okay. All right. Thanks all. Let's move on then to the consent calendar. We have several items on that consent calendar.
I'll make a motion to approve the consent calendar.
We have a motion to approve the consent calendar. I'll second that motion. Questions from any of the commissioners around that, around the consent calendar?
Hearing none from Sia.
Okay, so hearing no questions, do I bring the consent calendar to the public?
No.
Okay, all right. Well, then let's take the vote then.
Commissioner Norton?
Aye.
Commissioner Benson?
Aye.
Commissioner Coleman? Commissioner Coleman?
Is he unmuted?
I have the ability to unmute.
Okay, thank you.
So I don't know, Mindy, if you can make me a host or a co-host because I'm unable to unmute myself. But yes, on the consent calendar.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, let's move to item 9, communications, reports, and correspondence received. Starting with correspondence received, anything? I don't see anything in my packet.
Yeah, there is an item tonight we did receive, and this is a nod to staff. We received a acknowledgement award from SDRMA, which is the Special District Risk Management Authority, and it's the President's Special recognition to the Harbor District and acknowledges the award to recognize those with no paid claims during the prior 5 consecutive program years in the property liability program. So this is one thing that we really pride staff on, especially our field staff and maintenance staff. It's remarkable that we don't have any actions in that area. So this is, again, property liability claims or automobiles, rolling stock, et cetera. So they have a 5-year no claims history. Just want to acknowledge their efforts. Thank you.
Good job, staff. All right. Executive director's report.
Real brief tonight. So the Humboldt Harbor Safety had a visit, safety committee, that is, had a visit from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife OSPRIT administrator and the deputy administrator. Heather and her deputy were here, attended the meeting. And one of the things that's important to note is that we had put the intent out that the aquaculture community would join the Harbor Safety Committee as a voting member. That has to be approved through the OSPR administrator, and originally that appeared to be somewhat challenging, but after attending the meeting and speaking to us, it appears that we may have found a pathway for that to happen, so we're working on that with our aquaculture community. We had a field visit, which our district planner will update on here a bit later, to Humboldt Bay National Wildlife Refuge, specifically the Lagoons project that we've been updating you on. We recently hosted the California Community College's Chancellor's Office for a port discussion and learning excursion. We had their chief climate officer here, Dr. Carla Grandy. Crystal, who is she's a vice president at College of the Rebels. I think she's currently over instructional services. She was over student services, Crystal Morse. And then a fellow, Tammy Wong, that attended. So we were able to sit down here in the office, visit for a while, and then go out in the field with them, including on the bay. So I was really happy to have them here. They're looking at expanding some of the studies around climate activities. So good stuff. We've appointed a natural resources coordinator to join our team, Michael Sipra. I want to thank you to the professional panel at the recommendation of the public. We used a public panel or a professional panel to help in this hiring process. They made the recommendation. Staff accepted the recommendation as made an appointment. That individual will begin here in September. And then we have a cruise ship, you may be guessing that, coming in, the Crystal Symphony. It's an inaugural visit. This is perhaps the longest ship we've ever had visit our port, 781 feet. Sounds like we're back at a dock for a period of time. We thought we were going to have to anchor in the water and then use the tenders to bring people over to town, but it looks like we're going to be able to anchor up at Schneider Dock. So headed our way, and good things to come. Pass it off to Rob.
Okay.
You need the mouse? No. Okay.
I have no special report this evening, other than to say thank you to the Harbor District. It's been an honor to serve the district, and I'll always care a lot about Humboldt Bay and hope to see all of you soon.
Okay. Thank you, Rum.
Yeah.
Appreciate your service.
We really appreciate your service. You've done an incredible job, and we're so glad that you are in an even better position to guide Humboldt County. So great. Okay, do we have an engineering report tonight? Pl planning report?
Our engineer isn't here,
Okay.
but I will give his report.
Okay.
He did submit one. So they're overseeing a number of projects for us right now. So at the Fields Landing Boatyard, they're helping us support or develop what responses to bidders' questions may be. Really, that's a bit premature at this point in time. It's the packet that's going out to bid on the improvements for the stormwater system at the Fields Landing Boatyard. Then they will be supporting us with bidders' questions. They conduct dry weather inspections there each and every month to make sure all the BMPs are being managed appropriately, that storage is going as it should be, and that activities are in their authorized areas. Always prepping for winter. RMT-2 outfall line, support district with U.S. Army Corps coordination. So what Mike's referring to here is you'll remember our marine outfall line floated 2 years ago, and we are needing to have recurring replenishment of the beach. We talk about this frequently when we talk about the littoral cell. We've talked about the degradation of the Samoa Beach each year and the dredging material that comes out of the barn entrance. And that material is sand, spent, been found suitable for beneficial reuse and placement. So we've been working on a project with the Corps to see how we can use more of that material and perhaps consider direct beach placement. So more to come on that in the future. We're getting there. We're having a little technical glitch here. There we go. RM2 firewater. So we're looking at alternatives for providing firewater flows out to the mill. You'll remember back, well, some of you will anyhow, I guess you shouldn't, I can't say that. Back in 2019, not all of you were on the commission back then, the state fire marshal had come to the area and said, hey, look, we need firewater on the Humboldt Peninsula or the Samoa Peninsula. We did not have firewater. And so we came up with a way to repressurize the system that was out there and expand services from Revo and Internal 2 all the way up to the town of Samoa. Well, that is no longer necessary with the development in Samoa because they have their own water storage. The infrastructure that we were using for supply is failing faster than we can repair it or keep it there due to its age. And so we're looking at alternatives to replace the current water tank, which is about 100,000 gallons. It's an elevated tower tank, one of the landmarks many people see out there. And we replace it with a ground level surface tank with a flow switch and electric pump to keep our fire system pressurized at Revo and Terminal 2. Former LP Samoa solid wastewater site. So this is really just ground monitoring around the Samoa ash dump. And each year we have two monitoring sessions. We have an upcoming sampling session in August. Those numbers continue to look very well to stay in our post-closure status. Shelter Cove, we recently received FEMA funding for the road. So I'm too far away tonight, or why this mouse isn't working. We've been coordinating with Cal ES for boat launch action for road repairs. There's three repairs. There's the rebuilding of the breakwater. There's the road repairs. And then finally, there's a large scale debris removal project that we hoped would go first. So far, only the road has been funded. We received that funding just this past week. So we're working with SHN to see how we can commence studies permitting there, and then ultimately move that project to construction. Finally, RMT-1 brownfield, out as part of the heavy lift main terminal, but outside of that, we had received funding to support the cleanup of the former Redwood Marine Terminal 1 and some neighboring properties for those landowners that have consented to be a part of it. We recently received the draft phase ones. They're in the review process to be finalized. They can be shared with the agencies and our technical committee to move towards the sampling and analysis plan. And dredge reuse, we have a beneficial dredge reuse conference coming up that Rob was spearheading, and now we have Shelley from Moffitt Nichols spearheading for us. That'll be coming up in October, and so Mike is helping support that and be part of that conference. And Vanessa's here to offer her report.
It's pretty quick. Think of it. Just ongoing permit processing for Harbor District permit renewals, and then also received word that the Coastal Commission has accepted her filing in as complete the renewal for the Subtitle Mariculture pre-permitting project. So their hearing date is pending. Staff is working on their staff report, but that is good news that that is moving forward and will go to the Coastal Commission soon. Did meet with some Chevron dock representatives about improvements to their facility that they need to do next year. So pre-application meeting, talking about CEQA and other studies that will be needed to move that forward. And then, as Chris mentioned, we did go out to the lagoon site, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Humboldt RCD project out there. So the next slide is just a few pictures. They are moving around a lot of dirt. It was fun to get out of the office and go see that. There were some the adjacent property owners, and then Todd attended that as a tenant out there. And the Harbor District's role was really kind of to facilitate open communication. We have been receiving weekly updates from the applicants and from the property owners, and there are some concerns. And so we are working to just, you know, talk those through and do give as much support as we can to everyone. In terms of, you know, water quality sampling potentially, and then other some debris removal out there that, well, there's heavy equipment out there to try to get that done. And that's my report.
Okay, thank you. Okay, commissioner and committee reports. President Coleman, do you have a report?
Sure, thank you. First, I want to, you know, be sure to thank Rob so much for all his hard work and diligence and expertise that he's brought to the district. Our paths have crossed in many ways back to the Winslow and Kelly days, Rob, and I'm sure they'll continue to cross in future endeavors. I congratulate you on your new position. I know you'll do great, and they're lucky to have you. And then wanted to also announce, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I probably started seriously my engagement with WIGI Humboldt Bay, back in 2009 in my role as natural resources director for the Wiat tribe, and 2017, when Mike Wilson was elected to board of supervisors, I was appointed to this position. And so I've been serving, I'm on my 10th year now, and I made the decision not to file papers to run for another term. That was a tough decision. I've really treasured my time here. I'm proud of a lot of the work that we've done, but needed to focus on some other things. My job, which is very climate-driven, energy efficiency-driven, and family things. So, and the decision would have been much harder other than for knowing that there is a very qualified and capable and wonderful candidate willing to step up into this position for the third district Michelle Fuller, who I've known for a long time, also has tribal natural resources experience. So I'll be around still, finishing out my term for the end of the year. So not saying goodbye yet, but just wanted to announce officially that I am not seeking another term after this term's up.
Thank you, President Coleman. Jack?
I have nothing to report.
Okay. So I have a few things. First of all, I'm just so pleased that the natural resources coordinator position has been filled after 7 years. It's, I mean, really to keep the harbor, the recreation and conservation missions forward, so that we're not just a harbor commission or a recreation and conservation district as well. It's really important to have that position and that commitment by the harbor district to fill that role. And Mike Cipra, I'm just delighted. What a qualified person to have in there. Also my own I've also been attending the community advisory committee meetings here in well, the last one was in the afternoon, and I had it on my schedule to show up at 7 a.m. on Tuesday, and the place was empty. Sometimes you gotta update the meeting times in one's phone. So nothing wrong with being here at 7 a.m. on the island. So it was good. And also just meeting with Natalie Arroyo, meeting with Mike Wilson. Well, the 2x2 committee didn't meet, but just participating in all of the committees that I'm assigned to, and then kind of going the extra mile as well. Also, I just want to give an update on my own election filing of documents. I'm just in my fourth year, so I feel so I definitely want to run again, and so I've filed all those documents that we had to file by August 7th, and pay that $1,050 is the filing fee. It's democracy isn't cheap even here in Humboldt County, right? And I'm also super pleased to let the public know that there are two other candidates. So democracy is alive and well in Humboldt County, and I'm so pleased that there's that level of interest in serving on this commission. And I look forward to to there being choices for the folks of Division Four. And you'll see me also on the ballot. All right. So I think that's it. And we can move on to unfinished business. Item 10, receive status and update regarding the Humboldt Bay Offshore Wind Heavy Lift Marine Terminal Project.
Ready?
All right. We've got three great presentations tonight. I'm most excited about the first one, a new face for all of you. So David, I uploaded your presentation, but it didn't transition well. So I recommend you sharing your screen, but we can share screen here if you'd prefer.
David Will.
That's right.
Oh, can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. All right, let me I can share my screen.
While he's working on that, David's probably going to be humble, but he is the design engineer that led the first port in America to receive the Dark Skies International certification for ports.
Great.
So highly qualified team he's working with.
All right, and just let me share my screen. Let me know when y'all.
We can see and hear you.
Okay.
But not your presentation.
All right, make sure I'm sharing the right screen here. Let's try.
David's also in Atlanta, I believe.
I'm in Savannah.
Atlanta makes more
Yeah,
sense.
beautiful Savannah, South Carolina. All right. Let's try this again. Can y'all see my screen?
It's still black, but we see that you're transitioning. There we go.
Okay. I'm sorry I'm not in presentation mode. I always get confused which screen gets shown. Okay. When I do presentation mode. Well, I'll jump into it. So I'm David Wills, a senior electrical engineer at Moffett-Nickel. We're going to go over Humboldt Offshore Wind heavy lifts the marine terminal lighting portion of the project. So just a quick agenda, introduction and experience for myself. We're going to talk about port lighting requirements. We're going to talk about lighting port terminals in general. I'll share an example project, and then we're going to talk about dark sky compliance towards the end. So just a little bit about myself. I was asked to talk about that. So my name is, again, David Wills. I'm in Savannah, Georgia. I'm the senior electrical engineer. I lead our electrical discipline here at Moffett-Nickel. I've got over 20 years of experience. And just to be clear, Moffett-Nickel did the Port of Tampa Bay, which is first dark sky compliant project. I was not the engineer of record. I did participate in that project. I participated in the dark sky guidelines review specifically. So Moffett-Nickel teamed up with Musco Lighting and the dark sky program in Port of Tampa Bay and introduced that project. And that program is a new program. Again, we're going to talk about it towards the end. And I did get the honor of helping to participate in that guidelines review. So just in general, why light the port? The main reason you're lighting the port is specifically for safety and to allow for nighttime operations. And those are two separate things. And when we get into dark sky a little bit more later in the presentation, I'll explain the difference because there's different levels, and we will provide both a safety, so a security level, and then a nighttime operations level as required by the standards and by the dark sky compliant program. So what standards do we follow? So in general for ports, I kind of have these somewhat in order, but normally the lead standard is just the IES RP40-19. So IES is the Illumination Engineering Society. That is the RP40-19 is their port and waterfront standard. So specifically a standard written around how you light ports. And what that requirement, what that standard requires is 3.5 foot candles on average. And I'll talk about foot candles here in a second. But essentially that's how you measure light. In America, we typically measure by foot candles. You can also measure by lumens, but foot candles is what we go for. And the IES requirement is 3.5 foot candles on average. And just out of comparison, and then well, specifically for OSHA also in workspace requirements, OSHA requires 5 foot candles in general landside areas for ports. And what we're trying to do with this project is achieve that 5 foot candles just because, it is a workspace requirement. The entire terminal is a workspace. However, that is only when, and I'll get into this a little bit more in dark sky compliance. That will only be for specific times, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. And just out of comparison, your average parking lot, somewhere around 1.5 to 2.5 foot candles, depending on the county, the town requirements. So we're just above your average parking lot essentially in terms of light levels. And then the Coast Guard requirements is another standard. So the Coast Guard requires for ports security lighting. They require that specifically for security around the perimeter. So we have to light the terminals. Any port terminal in America, the Coast Guard requires us to light those for security reasons. So how do we light the terminal? First of all, I mentioned foot candles. So what is foot candles? A foot candle is a unit of measurement for light intensity. It's defined as 1 lumen per square foot. So it indicates how much light reaches the surface area. So it's commonly used in the United States for various light applications. Again, typical parking lot is, 1.5 to 2.5 foot candles. A typical office space is like about 30 foot candles. And what we're looking at around 5 foot candles on average. But again, we'll be lower than that much of the time. We'll talk about that. So we light these terminals with high mast lights, similar to what you see on a highway. If you drive past a highway and you see a tall pole, you can pretty much consider that a high mast light. Typically, they're around 49 to 164 feet. You can get taller than that. It's rare, but you can be taller than that. And they're designed for outdoor lighting, for highways, for stadiums, for parking lots, large parking lots. And then they provide broad and uniform light coverage for, with a limited number of poles. So you're trying to limit the number of poles. You're trying to make sure you cover the entire area. And then you're trying to, of course, improve your visibility and safety on the terminal. Right now, Humble, we are planning on 150 foot tall fixtures. The tall fixtures allow us to push the light further and light the port from the perimeter. And this is just a sketch. I'm still working on the lighting design. I just want to kind of show how we're lighting or how we're proposing to light the port. And again, we're still working on the design, and we're working with Musco and going through the Dark Sky program, and because I know the board is committed to that program. But again, we'll talk about those specifics in a little bit. So in general, though, we are lighting the terminal from the perimeter, so that light will be shining towards the terminal itself, away from the perimeter, and that just minimizes light trespass. So in general, the fixtures we're using too are specifically designed to minimize glare. I'll show an example of that, but you can see here the red dots are just an example of the high mast light locations. Again, all the way around the perimeter, we have a few interior that just lets us light up the larger, wider portions of the terminal. Those interior poles will be aimed such that interior light does not trespass past the border and past the perimeter of the site. And I know glare is an important factor of just in general, specifically the Dark Sky program also. And we always try to minimize glare. I actually have an example of a, this comes from the IAS RP40-19 manual. So this is the port standard. This is the IAS manual for lighting ports. And this example was actually near and dear to my heart. I work in Savannah. I do a lot of design work for Georgia Ports Authority, and this exact example picture came from Georgia Ports Authority. And we have two light fixtures, two manufacturers, I'm sorry, represented in this photo. And it really just shows an example of what glare control means. And with glare control, we are trying to make sure we minimize the uplight and try to minimize glare from the fixtures. And working with a manufacturer such as Musco designs their fixtures in a way where the light source is recessed in the fixture. And what happens is it reflects the light source off of the housing of the fixture. So you can't actually see the light source. You're actually just looking at reflected light. So in this picture, you'll see on the left-hand side here, on the left-hand side is a well, it's another manufacturer's fixture. I won't call out a name. On the right-hand side, you'll see those are Musco fixtures, and you can tell clearly the difference of how the light is controlled, how the light is targeted, and how glare is minimized. You can clearly see how the light is pushed down from the fixture. And you see the lack of uplight on these fixtures. Again, that Musco is the premier manufacturer of high mast lights in America. They're the number one sports light in America. Most of your ballparks, probably even around your area, have Musco fixtures. They're by far the largest sports lighting manufacturer, and they do awesome terminal lighting. And I would be honest, they're not the cheapest fixture, but they are the best fixture, bar none. And they do the best at minimizing glare, and do the best at targeting light. So you'll see in this example, the Musco lights on the right, and then the non-Musco lights, or I should say, a glare minimizer, or glare control light fixture on the right, and then a light source on the left that just doesn't minimize and doesn't control glare nearly as well. I'll give an example before we get in kind of talk about the Dark Sky program. I'll just give an example of the Connecticut State Pier. I believe it's completed somewhere around 2023 or so. And this is actually completed before the Musco program. But you can see again a similar look on these high mast lights. You'll see the glare, the minimized glare, and the target light going down. This is in New London, Connecticut. I'm standing, kind of across the water from it. You'll see the town behind it. And then this picture here is taken from on terminal. So I'm physically on terminal when I took this photo. You can see the light levels here. This is again, we shop around 5 foot candles. We have similar light levels. This was an operating night. You see some of the equipment and the cranes. But so when we're operating, we're at 5 foot candles, but normally we're much lower than 5 foot candles. And that kind of leads me into my dark sky compliance. So dark sky is a program that's been around for a number of years. The port program is fairly new. They released their first guidelines in July 2025. So the purpose of this program is to recognize port marine terminals that minimize light pollution, which includes sky glow, includes glare, and includes light trespass around the perimeter, while maintaining safe functional lighting based on the IS 5 principles for responsible outdoor lighting. And as part of that program, there's many things we have to meet. So first of all, you can see I just kind of gave a quick table of what we're meeting. So first of all, uplighting, so zero lumens emitted above 80 degrees from nadir air. So meaning that's what you see when you see that cone of light pushing down, that's minimizing the uplight. So we would definitely be minimizing uplight with our program, with our design. And then targeted lighting. So 90% of the lumens coming out of these fixtures have to fall within the work zones. So you're targeting where the light's going. You're not just throwing light. You're targeting light. So with these high mast lights, every fixture will be individually aimed in order to target the light where we want it to be. We're not going to have any ring fixtures. You may see those oftentimes on highways. You'll see a single high mast light with a kind of a halo of lights around it. So you'll have 6 to 12 lights just kind of in a halo at the top of the picture, just throwing light. We won't have that on this program. We will have targeted lighting. We'll have fixtures that are individually aimed to target where we want the lights. And then light trespass. So as part of this program, you'll have less than 20 luxes at water's edge. I'll explain. So a foot candle is essentially around 10 luxes. So at the water's edge, we have to minimize how much light gets to the water's edge in order so you won't have light spill onto the water. So that's also part of the design. Like we have to concern ourselves with minimizing the light at the water's edge. And then less than 0.1 luxes at 150 feet into the water, and then less than 3 luxes at non-port property. And that's a difficult, I will admit that's difficult to meet. And so that's something we work with hand in hand with MUSCO in order to meet that. I've already started communication with them. We've had several meetings and communications back and forth. We feel like we would definitely be able to meet that. But that shows you, so we're less than, again, we're around 10 and some change luxes per foot candle. So we're much less than 0.3. We're about 0.3 foot candles at the non-port property. So we're minimizing light trespass onto the adjacent spaces. Illuminance, again, we're 25% above target average. Sorry, less than or equal to 25% above target average. And the average minimum ratio of 5 to 1. And what that means is we've got uniform lighting. We won't have any hot spots. We'll have nice uniform lighting. And then color temperature, that's a big thing nowadays. It's no more than 4,000 K. And then, preferred status, less than or equal to 3,000 K. But we definitely won't be any more than 4,000 K. You won't have your blue lights. That's a concern when you're in. And what a K is, by the way, is Kelvin. It's a way to measure color temperature based off of, well, I won't get into specifics, but it's a way to measure color temperature. And specifically, that blue light that people get concerned about is in that 5,500, 5,000, that daylight. If you buy a fixture from Home Depot, that daylight, that 5,000, that 5,500 K. So we will be no more than 4,000 K. And then controls, and this is really where I wanted to kind of hit on a little bit more. So controls, dimming's required, and that's standard now with LED lights. As you all know, there's, dimming is everything should be dimmed these days. You got an LED light. So astronomical on off, meaning the lights come on and off based off an astronomical time clock. And then separate zones per work zones. And that's the key there. So what it is we're going to establish work zones on the port. And we don't know what those work zones are yet. I'd say somewhere maybe around two or three, but we're working on, no pun intended, we're working on the work zones and defining those work zones. And what will happen is, as part of the dark sky program, the lights, when they come on, based off the astronomical on off, they don't come on at the 5 foot candles full brightness. They come on at around 1 foot candle. It's about one and some change. We dimmed it down about 30%. So we're just over the foot candle. That also meets the security, kind of the guidelines from the Coast Guard. So we're going to be much dimmer. We're going to be dimmer than a park than a traditional store parking lot most of the time when it's not operating. And then when the terminal operates, at that time, the lights are brought can be brought up to full brightness. And it's not like, there's there would be concern for me is, I don't want somebody, they're operating tonight, they turn the button on and then they forget and now stays every day now from here on out where at 5 foot candles. No, every day when it comes on, it will be at your required security level lighting. And then they will have to initiate. You can do that, from your phone, from your iPad, but they'll have to bring it up based off the operational conditions. They'll bring it up to that 5 foot candle kind of working light. But in general, though, we will be, depending on the operation, how often the port is operated, again, when it's not operating, we'll be at a much lower level, even lower than a traditional parking lot. And then just quick overview of the dark sky requirements, implications, design. Again, we'll have several phases, and it's not like we just say we're dark sky compliant. No, we have to first submit an online application. We have to submit our lighting calcs to dark sky, our control schedule, what I was just talking about, our control schedule, how we're going to control the light, and there's a small fee for that also for their review. And so it's not just David Wills, it's not just Musco saying, oh yeah, we're dark sky compliant. The dark sky program reviews your design. They'll give you comments. We may have to adjust our design based off the comments. That's all part of going through and making sure we're dark sky compliant. So they'll review it, and then once we've met the criteria, they'll issue us a letter of compliance. And then, it's not like that letter of compliance, you're good. No, there's actually once the program is once the terminal is designed and built and constructed, there's an on-site field inspection. So dark sky representative will come out to the field, and they will actually issue us a full certificate once they confirm we were meeting the requirements. And again, great, benefits of it. The primary benefit why we want to be dark sky compliant is community stakeholder validation, environmental responsibility. It's a way for the community, and for us and for the board who's concerned about it to show that, yes, we are responsible with the design of the light systems for this project. And then we will also get, just some labels and be able to say we're dark sky compliant. That's the end of my presentation.
Thank you very much, David. Stand by. There may be some questions from commissioners and staff, and then we'll also have public comment after that.
I sure will.
Yep. Stephen, do you have any comments or questions?
No, nothing for me. Thanks.
Okay.
I'm just kind of wondering about the dark sky compliance. Is maybe you can tell me a little bit more, like is that an industry standard or is that a what sort of background came up with the standard of or making sure that it meets certain criteria?
Yeah, absolutely. So Dark Sky International, and I just happen to have this up, and I'll read it directly just as they say from the website. Dark Sky International is a nonprofit organization that works to restore the nighttime environment and combat light pollution. So that's their goal. And Dark Sky has been around for some time, and it being coming to the port environment is fairly new, but Dark Sky as a organization has been around for a while. But of course, dark side saw an opportunity to say, hey, we've got ports all over the world. We are concerned about dark sky's concerned about light pollution everywhere. They want to minimize light pollution. So they saw an opportunity, like, let's go out to the port environment and see if we can bring our knowledge, our environmental responsibility and concern of the community to the port world.
Yeah, I was just wondering, maybe do you know of any legal challenges to dark skies criteria, and has anybody's been successful in some lawsuits or saying that they were harmed by too much light pollution, even though they were dark sky certified?
That's a good question. I'm not aware of that. That's something I can look into. I'm not aware if they have had any issues in terms of them saying the dark sky compliant, and yet people are challenging that. So that's something I can look into though.
David, it sounds as if dark sky certification is kind of the highest standard for keeping lights as low and as contained as any other certification. It seems like it's the highest standard. Is that true, or are there
Yeah,
that are greater than that?
absolutely. Yeah, so dark sky is respected throughout the world, and definitely, it is a standard, and especially for ports. Again, that's somewhat of a big deal for a port to be dark sky compliant. Ports are always, obviously ports are concerned about their community, but having dark sky compliance at a port is a big deal. And that's why Tampa, initiated this. They want to show with a particular project that they're working on that they took the community's well-being into account, and becoming dark sky compliant is the way to do that.
David, do you mind bringing back up your presentation? You had a couple of photographs that I want to ask some specific questions about.
Sure.
As you're bringing it up, the questions that I'm going to have is, what are the height of those masts, relative to the 150 foot tall, mast lighting that is anticipated for this project? I'd just like to know what heights of what we're seeing might be like the
And
from this angle, from a distance, right? What's the height of those masts?
yeah, so this is Connecticut State Pier, and these are Musco fixtures, and these are 150 foot tall poles.
So similar to this.
Yes, sir.
Okay, can you come into the other one that really shows the lighting on site? I think it's the next slide. So how much does the surface, the color of the concrete, the color of the buildings, I'm imagining there's a lot of light reflection off of surfaces here. So it's not only what's coming down from the mass, but also what it's bouncing off of and how it reflects. Are there ways to also reduce light by the colors of the ground and the buildings?
Yeah,
Go
I think
ahead.
that's a good question. Typically, with the port environment, you don't get as much light reflection just because oftentimes you're using darker surfaces, textured surfaces. Unlike a solid, brighter surface where you can get more light reflection, a lot of light is absorbed on the surface just because, again, you're using typically darker materials, dark grays, your asphalts, and they're typically softer materials. So light reflection, the buildings are something you could definitely look into. How do you minimize light reflection off a building? That's a metal hard surface. That's something that as we go into the program further, we definitely can consider. I think that's a great question. And that's something we should consider. So how do we minimize that? Typically with the light fixtures and we're replacing them, we're going to try to minimize, throwing light even off the top of the building if we can. So that's something we take into account.
I mean, is this pretty typical of the amount of ambient lighting that you would see if you're on the site, or is the albedo of the snow in this picture actually amplifying
Oh,
the light on?
that's interesting. Yeah, so I think we were maybe a little bit brighter. There were some areas of snow, so you'll see kind of in the foreground here, especially around this building, you'll see some reflection off the snow. That's a really interesting point. I remember I was there in February. It was quite cold, but yeah, I think it is typical. This is typical of the operating light too. I want to be clear about that. When it's not operating, it's much dimmer than this. I mean, you can almost say it, I dim it down at about 30%. So this is the operating, and this is on terminal operating levels. And again, it's around 5 foot candles. Again, your house, your office is typically 30 foot candles. When you're outside, your eyes adjust, so you can typically capture light more. Again, in a off average store parking lot is somewhere around 1.5 to 2.5 foot candles on average.
In a future presentation, if you get an opportunity to show more pictures of us, and we respond well to pictures because it gives us an idea. If you could show us any industrial site that, rather than just having open fencing, has cl closed fencing with slats or sound walls, and especially where there might be dense vegetation and even trees that could be really interesting to see a cross section of how much that light expand is goes past an intentional kind of barrier
Okay.
created. Be nice, just be interesting to see that.
Yep. Yeah. That makes sense. And that's something again. That's when we do our design, we light trespass, right? Is that light that's going past where it's supposed to be? And that's something that is critical with the dark sky program, and just responsible lighting in general. And that's something that we'll look at. And when we do our calculations, you'll see the light trespass past the past the edge of the perimeter to make sure we're dark sky compliant. I've got some photos I can definitely share.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to take it back to Rob. I have a question for you. I want to give the public a chance to comment. Is it best to see all the presentations and have a public comment period, or do you think it's worthwhile to have public comment per item?
I'd probably defer that to our district council, but if you do comments for each presenter, are you allowing an individual to comment three times?
Thank you.
Generally, it'd be after the end of all the presentations.
Okay, well, we'll stick with that protocol. I just wanted to see. Okay, ready for the next then.
All right, next up
Thank you so much,
is.
David.
You're welcome.
And David, there may be additional questions for you at the end of the other two presentations. So
Sounds
hopefully.
good. I'll be here.
All right. So our next one is about dredging. I believe Shelley's going to present, or may no, she had a colleague. It may not have been Shelley that was presenting. John Feingold.
Okay, I was trying to unmute. I'll turn the camera on here as well. Do you guys let me? Oh, there it is. Hey guys, John Feingold with Moffett Nickel. I've been in the dredging industry just under 20 years now, and been working on this project for a little bit. And I was going to give you guys a presentation on what we've come up with. Let me share my screen here. For just a real high level general, oh nope, that's the wrong one. Here we go. Of how the how we see this project coming together. So you'll see from my background, I live down in Long Beach, California. I've traveled all over the country dredging, ended up here. I lucky enough to work in Humboldt once on the dredge bay port, clearing the entrance channel, beautiful place, and a fond memory of mine. But I'll go ahead with the project here. So from my perspective as a career dredge guy, there's a lot that's interesting about this project. It's big, it's 6 million cubic yards. That's a good size project. And but what's really attractive about it is there's just a huge opportunity to beneficially reuse the material, which is something you like to see. So that means you're taking material that you dredge for navigation purposes, and you're using it, to better the community or nature, which is what we see a lot on this project with the huge beach fill quantity. So that's something that I think is unique. So out of 6.3 million yards, 4.5 million directly go to the beach. And besides that, there's another 2 million that's going to be used for surcharge and then go to the beach after. But I'll go through that in the sequence. So before I get into the sequence, I just want to talk about the different types of dredges, just to get everybody in the room caught up. So the first type of dredge I'm going to talk about is a clamshell dredge, and this kind of it's a type of derrick barge. It just looks like a crane, but it basically has souped up winches and a way stronger boom and can move really fast. So you need stronger winches because unlike a civil construction crane that's going to be hoisting lines with many parts, a dredge needs to use one line so it can go really fast because time is money on a dredge. And if you're going to dig buckets all day, you just need that bucket cycle. You need that swing cycle to go as fast as possible. So that's what's different about a clamshell dredge than a regular derrick barge. They're really good for surgical type of work. So you see them working a lot around docks. They're great for demo. You know, you can chew through an old timber dock just fine with one of these machines. And they're also good for long distance disposals because they load what we call a scow, which I'll get into a little more on the next slide, I think, or the one after that. And another thing a clamshell dredge is really good for when you're dealing with demolition is sifting through debris. It's better suited than any other dredge type for that. And the main tool for that is shown here on this slide. We call them grids or grizzlies, and those will sit on top of the scow. A big grid, you know, very heavy steel, usually spaced 1 foot by 1 foot, and you can separate rocks and demolition debris from your dredge material, mud or sand, which is a useful tool in a lot of these projects, can particularly ones that contain demolition and ports. And then we're going through here on this slide. We're just talking about the different disposal types. The disposal methods you can use with a clamshell dredge. The top one, you're unloading to land, which is pretty slow but necessary sometimes. And then at the bottom, you're seeing the scow splitting its hull and bottom dumping. So these scows, they're actually two separate holes that are joined together with a massive hinge, and they use these very large hydraulic rams to open and close. So it's like the dump truck of the water, and they used tugboats to push them around because they don't have any built-in propulsion. So this is the project, and here what I'm showing you is the parts of the project that we have considered for that'd be good for clamshell dredging, and it's basically all along the shoreline. You know, the clamshell dredge will dig up the slope. It'll facilitate demolition of any existing structures, and it'll prepare the slope for rock, which will be used to, you know, it's the first step to constructing the new wharfs.
John, could you clarify that slide there? There's a lot of colors, and you and I are very familiar with what we're looking at, but I imagine the audience isn't. So you're
Oh,
talking
no problem. Yeah,
about.
thanks, Rob. So the colors on top, I'll talk about a little more as we get into the phasing, but those are the surcharge areas. So because this site is going to take a lot of weight from all these big, you know, for all these heavy objects that are going to be on here, we have to strengthen the soil. So to do that, we make basically big mounds of dirt that will, or sand that will compress the earth and get a desirable strength that can be used later for, you know, industrial purposes. We do this quite a bit on, you know, to build ports out of water. You know, here in Long Beach, you know, we build land of, you know, from places that were once ocean, and this is the method we use to compress that material, that dredged material, and make it suitable so that, you know, you can put shipping containers and you know, cargo on top of it, and it can hold cranes. That blue outline is what I was trying to highlight in this slide, and that's just showing you of all the places that get dredged on this project. That's the area that's going to be best for clamshell dredging.
Thank you.
No problem, Rob. Thank you. All right, and the next type dredge type we're going to talk about is a cutter suction dredge. These are bigger, they're faster, and because they're so productive, and because they dig so fast, they're going to be quite a bit cheaper per cubic yard when you're digging bulk quantities. So we like to use these dredges out in the open. They can pump a couple miles through that pipeline that you see in the back of that dredge. And these dredges are typically made, you know, to make land, like I was talking about in the port, or to build beaches, or you know, to clear channels as well. And they can pump about 3 miles. Or this one can. They come in all sizes. This is the biggest one on the West Coast. As you can tell, I worked with this dredge for a long time, and have a lot of pictures. So a picture up top is from the Port of Long Beach, and that was a landfill on project where we were making land out of ocean. You can see in the top right that's the area that was being filled. And you can see in the middle of this picture, you can see the dredge working around a bunch of other equipment on that project. And these other two pictures just show what the discharge end looks like. It's a lot of material moving out of that pipeline, and there's a full crew of what we call yellow equipment, bulldozers and loaders that are tending that pipe and shaping that discharge as it comes out of that as it comes out of the pipeline. And then back to our project. What I'm showing here is the areas we anticipate for cutter suction dredging. So there's it, it and it's basically that big section of the approach into the wharf, and then the wet storage areas and the sinking basin. So the majority of the project.
And those are the areas outlined in red.
Correct. Correct. Those are the red areas. All right. Well, if there's no questions on the dredges, I'm going to go ahead and get into the plan we've come up with. So in year one, we would have a clamshell dredge working, digging those two areas in blue I have outlined, and then we're going to have the cutter suction dredge start in that red outline area, but part of the approach. And we would have them start filling that first surcharge area. That's about 1 million cubic yards in what we understand is going to be the 3 month season where a cutter suction dredge could work. 1 million cubic yards is what we would expect they could accomplish in that season. So that's how we size these surcharge areas. So, and when you build a surcharge, you surround it with dikes, and you have a weir system to drain the water that's coming off. That way, when this material comes out at high velocity out of this pipeline, that way it has a lot of space to settle out, and then the water leaves the site. So the idea is, in the interest of getting this thing built, getting as much surcharge down as you can the first year you can show up with a cutter suction dredge, and that year, of course, there's plenty to do for the clamshell. They work a little slower. The main goal that year is going to be digging out that. What I call South Slope 2, right in front of Area 2 there. And I'll tell you why in a minute. So year two dredging, there's a potential that some of this material in the North Slope 1 area, in the clamshell area, under the existing dock, there's a potential that it will not be able to go to the ocean disposal site. If that is the case, we will have built a dock here on at the South Slope area where we'll unload it to land. It's not harmful or dirty or anything like that. There's just a lot of regulation about what can be disposed offshore, and we just haven't run the tests yet to understand whether or not all this material can go there. So the idea is to get that South Slope two area to have a functioning wharf there, and then this material from the North Slope one area can be offloaded there. That also facilitates the demolition of the old timber wharf. Meanwhile, the cutter suction dredge comes back, and it in the second season, and it'll start filling up surcharge area two, which is about 1 million yards, maybe a little less, maybe more like 800,000 for that one. Then year three, we just kind of keep moving through the site. The clamshell dredge is going to continue to dig to complete slope sections to prepare the slope for construction. The cutter suction dredge is going to move to the wet storage areas where the bulk of the material is on the project. And at this point, the cutter suction dredge is just going to pump all that material straight to the beach for beneficial reuse. On land and the surcharges at this point, surcharge area one has sat for a year, which is what we anticipate will be required to get the settlement we're looking for. And then that material gets pushed into surcharge area three. And then years four through seven, very similar. The cutter suction dredge just kind of keeps moving through these big wet storage areas to dig these out, send that material to the beach because our soil program has our soil testing program has indicated it's beautiful beach sand down there, and the surcharges get pushed along through these areas, and then as they're done surcharging the various surcharge areas to get the settlement we want, that gets pushed to the beach as well. All right, should we take questions now?
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm sure there's a lot of questions because there's a lot of detail that you didn't go into. Let me start with I'm going to put some of my questions out first. The clamshell and cutter suction dredging. Which type of dredging minimizes turbidity in the bay in general? And what kind of BMPs? I didn't see best management practices in terms of, booms with silt curtains, anything to contain the turbidity, whichever way the tide is going, whether it's slack tide or incoming or outgoing tide. We're really concerned about water quality, and not exporting turbidity off site. Are there BMPs that are going to help with that, or do you have other slides that could show us what that looks like?
Yes, there are. I don't have anything prepared to show you. But yes, specifically when you're using the clamshell dredge, it's achievable to wrap that operation in silt curtain, and that can help quite a bit. As far as the cutter suction dredge, the main BMP you use is you control the water that flows back out of the fill site with a weir system, and I could prepare you some sketches of that at a later time to show you exactly how that works.
Yeah, at some point we'll want to really dig into the details. I realize we didn't give you 2 hours to go into that level of detail. Another area of detail will be how will the what's the actual conveyance method for piping and pumping, and what routes would it take to get material to the beach? Because we're going through a town here, and what impacts might that be on traffic? And I'm assuming we're using some the existing one of the existing culvert systems, but it would be good to have some more detail on, rather than just lines that you put on an air photo that says, this material is going to be pumped to the beach. I'm sure there are people in the audience in the house right now said, wait, that arrow goes right through my house. How are you going to actually?
Yeah, they're not to be taken literal, but yeah, as you mentioned, we would utilize the culverts, and we can work on a detailed plan to present at a later time on that.
Do you do horizontal tunneling in order to create a low impact way of doing this, or is it always on top of the ground? Maybe there's just a basic question that you can.
I've never seen a direct drilling operation in support of a dredge, for dredging, but that doesn't mean it can't be done. I've seen culverts used before, and oftentimes, yeah, it's placed, above ground.
Commissioner Benson, there are two tunnels under Old Navy Base Road, and so there are paths to those that no one would see.
Yeah.
So it would be on ground, but under the road.
I know that those exist under the road. I wasn't sure how far those extended into the town.
I think John will probably give you a presentation in the future
Yeah,
about the
yeah,
path, but
yeah.
there are a couple of good viable paths.
Yeah, I knew that there were. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions from other commissioners before we see the next presentation? Okay.
Well, I appreciate the feedback.
Yep. If you can hang in there may be additional questions for you. And so our last presenter is Scott. Regarding green terminal plan. That's right. Yeah. Scott Lusso. I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Liquor. Hi, good evening, everyone. Just getting off of mute here and trying to turn on my video. There we go. Good to be with everybody. Good to be with you, commissioners and staff and members of the community. My name is Scott Liquor. I am Moffat and Nichols, Director of Waterfront Planning and Design, with 30 years of experience in waterfront design, really across the United States and elsewhere. I'm going to give you an update on where we are on the Green Terminal roadmap, and let me please have a moment here to share my slides, which are coming up on monitor. Let's go with monitor two. Here we go. And let me put this into presentation mode. All right. So hopefully this is all coming through. And again, certainly happy to be here with everyone this evening. So this is a project that kicked off. Really, this just kind of just origins. You know, the component of this project was requested through Board Resolution 2024-01. Which required the preparation of a green terminal strategy and roadmap. It really was intended to provide goals and a timeline for achieving net zero carbon emissions in site operations. The work that I'm presenting tonight across the nine different slides really commenced in the spring of 2025. It advanced through the assembly of a Green Terminal Advisory Committee. It allowed us to collect the data that we needed and draft baseline emissions analysis for the current design. We got through the summer of last year. We held two advisory committee meetings, and of course, then the project was put on hold. But we have since, of course, restarted the project. We restarted in July, and we continue to move on a timeline to get to the ultimate objective. The ultimate objective is the current design today includes significant infrastructure that will help the project avoid greenhouse gas emissions really from day one. In many ways, the project is best of class when it comes to these types of heavy lift facilities and the things that have already been thought and included you know, in the overall project overall. What we're doing through the Green Terminal strategy is building on that foundation. We're identifying the technologies and operating practices that can be phased in over time to help reduce those remaining emissions that are on the site. And as you'll see, most of them are associated with operational equipment on the site, crawler cranes, and certain vessels that are operating in the harbor, both tugs and other types of vessels. To see what types of ways and what types of approaches we can eventually get to zero carbon as the project is delivered in phases over time. And the key point here is really it's a progression. So we're trying to design the terminal to start cleaner and then, of course, improve over time to get to that goal of zero carbon. We've been doing that across three main tasks. First, and where we were able to get in our work last year is to model the emissions for the current project design. And since the restart, we have been working to update that model based on some small changes and tweaks to overall project delivery times and some components. We really want to make sure we understand where the emissions are coming from and in what quantities, of course, we're looking at in the present design. And then second, we're developing and evaluating different decarbonization pathways, and these are intended to get us to zero carbon over time. And then finally, we're putting all that together into a practical green terminal strategy and roadmap, one that shows how we can move towards net zero and make sure we do that in an easy, understandable document with lots of graphics, infographics, and visuals so that it is highly able to convey the ideas and the thoughts and the components to, you know, really, you know, grant agencies, the public at large, and decision makers in a really good synopsis. The area that we're studying is shown, of course, on the site plan on the right-hand side of your screen. It includes all the landside elements of phase one and phase two, shown in the blue and green, and of course, the adjacent vessel berths to the landside operational zone. It also includes the wet storage berths adjacent to the terminal, shown in bays that are in the harbor. So this is sort of the area that we've demarcated for our baseline emissions analysis, where we know and have designed components, and we have inventoried equipment that's operating in these zones. And we understand the emissions associated with those different types of equipment in that area, or each of these areas, the blue, the green, and the beige. What it doesn't include, of course, is things that are happening outside of the fence line, that are on the road, that are happening in the channels and navigation that brings equipment out into install sites. Those are not included in the emissions analysis. Really, in terms of trying to get to zero carbon, are much more difficult to control for the harbor district and for the port itself to really be able to say, all right, we can make meaningful improvements and approaches to control things that are sort of outside of our fence line. We see that you have a much greater ability to do so within those colored and with the property that were shown here, and that's really why we've defined that as the sort of the key zones that we're evaluating. And of course, as we talked about, the project is being delivered in phases. And currently, and sort of the most up-to-date design, phase one starts to build out in 2034, with phase two following a couple of years later in 2036. And the model reflects that all the way currently to a forecast year of 2045. In terms of emission sources in today's design, there's really four main categories. As you can see here on the slide, there's the terminal equipment, there's the vessels and harbor craft, there's sort of on-road vehicles inside the fence line, and then there's terminal buildings and sort of other related infrastructure. The landside equipment is crawler cranes and generators and water sources and delivery vehicles, and all sorts of other components associated, with the overall operation. And it's important to note that, the current design, as I mentioned, in many ways, this is considered sort of a best-in-class type of facility for its type. You already have in the design extensive electrification of in-yard equipment, vehicles, forklifts, those types of elements that are sort of doing the smaller tasks in the port. You have shore power systems that are linking vessels to the berths. You have site solar and other emissions reducing features that are sort of built into the mix and built into the current design. And of course, all of those are layered into the model and the analysis that work that has been up to this date, done up to this date. I am not sure where the rest of that slide seems to have gone. That's strange. So let me see here. That's very odd. Let's show that again here. Okay. So now I've kind of shifted. Hopefully you can see the PDF, because I'm not sure what happened to the PowerPoint. Shown on this slide is the completed baseline emissions model work. Of course, building the model, taking all the equipment and all the components, understanding their emissions and their ratings, and then doing the forecasting associated with that in the model, and doing that over time. And this is a model that we continue to perfect. We've circulated the baseline analysis that was prepared to the advisory committee, and we continue to make small changes and tweaks to it as things are finalized in the design itself. I think most importantly, the key finding from the baseline analysis is that the activities really from three main sources: the activities by crawler cranes, by the harbor tugs, and the delivery vessels account for almost 82% of modeled CO2 emissions over the analysis period out to 2045. Crawler cranes are the largest source. They're about a third, a little over a third, about 37%, followed by the harbor tugs at 26% and delivery in-water delivery vessels at 19%. So when we can clearly identify, four-fifths, 82% of emissions coming from three sources, it's only logical that that's where we're going to focus in our decarbonization scenarios, is to tackle those biggest emission sources to as the best we are able to start to move and push down towards our zero carbon effort. On an annualized basis, that information is not shown on the slide. We're looking at approximately 16,000 tons of carbon dioxide emissions per annum once phase two is fully implemented. And I know we're kind of focused on CO2, but the analysis and the model does output, and we have results from nitrogen oxides, NOx, sulfur oxides, SOx, the particulate matter, methane, and other key greenhouse gas components and measurements that are important to really understand where we are and how we can better the overall project. Following the baseline analysis, we've also started to move into what are the decarbonization strategies. For here, we're really evaluating two strategies for reducing emissions, and of course, focusing on those big three: the crawler cranes, the harbor tugs, and the delivery vessels. The first scenario really focuses on what we call low to moderate risk decarb measures and operational practices, and the second looks at more moderate to high risk measures. And when we refer to low to moderate versus a moderate to high scenarios, what we're really talking about are different levels of risk and ambition in the decarbonization pathway. We're looking at factors such as technology readiness and availability, operational flexibility, infrastructure requirements, cost, implementation, timing, and other features to really have a more holistic understanding of each of the components as they're sort of listed in their respective rows and columns. So for example, we're looking clearly at equipment in water and landside, its ultimate electrification or hybrid activity, such as hybrid or electric crawler cranes or alternative fuel tugs or battery systems, hydrogen-ready vessels and other types of things across this sort of low to medium or medium-high type of different types of scenarios. And of course, what we can see is potentially there might be another 60-80% or more of emission savings when compared to the baseline in each one of these categories. These are just early planning assumptions. We're looking at them at a high level, but they really help us understand the scale and the opportunity and ultimately the trade-offs associated with getting to different net zero pathways. And we're not just locked into any one particular column. It's not like we can only do baseline, we can only do the first scenario, we can only do the second scenario. There's not exclusivity, but what we expect is plan and the ultimate roadmap will have flexibility to sort of pick and choose from each of those columns where it makes the most sense based on some of the overall objectives and things that I mentioned before about infrastructure availability or cost or implementation timing to hopefully get as close as we can to zero carbon and then make some recommendations how to squeeze that last little bit out of the process to get to the ultimate goal. We are, of course, looking at those big three. We're looking at everything, of course, that is going to help us squeeze out and get rid of emissions over time as we implement the project to get to that goal of zero carbon. But clearly, understanding that 82% is super important. This slide just gives you one example of how we're looking at a high level of each one of the assets and the technological readiness of these assets as they currently exist. For example, electronic or electric crawler cranes, they're emerging as a promising option, but they require a lot of specialized charging infrastructure. And of course, there are some the possibility for hydrogen-powered cranes, and they may offer even greater flexibility. But of course, there's a supply issue. But as we evaluate these technologies, our goal is to encourage and enable port and equipment operators to adopt some of these cleaner equipment options over time while maintaining flexibility as the market evolves. And we also have to recognize, and we'll give a strong data and understanding as to many of these specialized equipment types, they're just not available in large quantities. In some cases, they're very much in their infancy, and they're not sort of readily available today. And maybe in some cases, we're looking in the mid 2030s before we could see, a number of them that might be available to the degree that we could see that on site here in Humboldt. And we're going to give some good direction on that as well. And then finally, it of course is the roadmap. We've already started sort of authoring the roadmap and the end product as I described. We really want to make sure it's clear and it's practical, that is highly visual, and we'll take the emissions analysis, the technological options, the implementation considerations, and turn those into, as I mentioned, a phase strategy, taking from each of those columns, the baseline, the low to moderate, and the moderate high different approaches, and give a clear picture of the actions and how those actions could occur over time, what they might cost, where there's flexibility built into the system, and how we can get the biggest bang for our buck, especially focusing on that 82% right out of the gate to get us towards that zero carbon terminal and future that we desire. We will have a I expect this document will be 20 to possibly 30 pages in length, and we'll have a almost poster-sized graphic of the overall project with infographics talking about specific elements as to emissions today and where we expect emissions to be in the future based on some of the components as well. That concludes my update. The expectation is, we're here, of course, in mid-August. We're making really good strides on the work product in each one of those three tasks. We're on a little bit of a pause with working with the advisory committee as the committee structure overall is being assessed, but we're really looking forward to re-engaging with them at the appropriate time to move them through and get their important feedback as to the work product and the ultimate roadmap. And with that, I'll turn it back to the board for questions.
Thank you so much, Scott. That was super informative. It was really great to get some sense of the roadmap and of those areas on the different sectors in which you'll be looking at it. Here, my overarching question is this. It seems like what we've scoped you to do is to really look at how can we have a zero work towards a zero emission port. What's that journey like? And mostly the greenhouse gases, methanes, NOx, SOx, et cetera, on from our particular site in the time that we use it. I guess I'm curious, is this report going to include, or did we include in your scope, talking more about cradle to grave of let's just take batteries. Just the fact that we're using a battery, is it all positive points that we've reduced emission, or are we looking at the mining to get lithium to create the batteries to bring them here, how we use them, how they get recycled or repurposed or finally disposed of? Are we looking at cradle to grave kind of scenarios with the materials here, or are we just looking at once they're in our hands, what we do with them on site?
Yeah, it's really the latter. Once we get the equipment on site, what are those operational emissions and elements? What are their current measures, and how do we mitigate those through behaviors, through technological selection, to get to an annualized basis of near or right at zero carbon?
I'm going to defer to President Coleman, who has his hand up. Go ahead, Stephen.
Oh, thank you. No, you could have finished if you had any additional questions. But one comment on the cradle to grave aspect. While I think that's highly important in like planning decisions, I think a lot of that work on these technologies has been done. So I don't think that's something that we want to, frankly, also pay our consultants to recreate work that's already been done and pretty accepted. But I think, as we're making decisions as a board, that's something we can definitely take into account. And similar to that, I'm going to bring up another tricky one, but I think it would be more on our aspect when we're making decisions and weighing, what sort of measures and mitigations we want to take. it would be great to have an analysis of some of the non-greenhouse gas benefits, co-benefits to some of these green strategies. So, if by providing electric engines, are we also reducing noise level? Are we reducing localized air quality impacts? And so I think getting that full picture of how much bang for the buck are we getting for each particular option? Because there might be something, if we change a fuel, but it's still combustion fuel, it might re be reducing greenhouse gases, but it might not be having any other impacts, while some other measures might. And
Yeah,
so I
Stephen,
guess to form that in a question, is that something that you might be looking at as well?
that's a great question, Stephen. And in the summary, and you really couldn't see it on the slide, they're little tiny dots right now, but we're using icons and giving information towards exactly that, the co-benefits associated with certain choices. And we see a lot of follow-on work that can dig deeper, kind of post this deliverable. To really tease those out in a much more detailed way. But at a high level, we 100% are, in fact, looking at the co-benefits associated with some of the choices and their trade-offs in each one of these scenarios and approaches.
Okay, any other questions from commissioners or staff?
I don't have any.
Okay, I think we have David, John, and Scott standing by. And so I want to open it up to the public. I just want to remind the public that your 3 minutes of comment doesn't really allow questions. That's why I'm asking as many as I can. So it's just comment. You can put questions out, but they won't necessarily be answered at this very moment. All right. Who would like to comment? Just step up if you're ready to comment on any of these three presentations or on all of them.
I'll do my best. I can't ask a question, but I can make a comment.
It's comments. You can pose questions, just don't expect anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
So my comment for the let's go with the dark sky. My question is to you, if how does fog affect the not sure the did he say the glow or the glare?
Yeah.
So just want to know, how does that affect it? Does that illuminate it even more? Or, and then another question, because they have control of when it comes on, I still haven't had a clear answer whether or not this is going to be a 24 operation. So if it's five candles, 24 hours, there won't be any control of this dial that says, oh, we're working 6 hours this day, 2 hours this day. And how does the fog affect production and the lighting on that? And then for the dredging, I'm curious the discharge line that goes out 3 miles out to wherever the location is, does that affect anything? Is that again buried underneath and where I would have to avoid that area where that pipe is because of a 7 foot draft of my boat? And that's just a question. I'm not sure. I came from Santa Cruz. I've seen this line go all around along the whole beach and then find an area to go, discharge of it. And so my question is, will I have to, or anybody navigating through there, have to be, being have to avoid that? And then the last question I have is, or comment is, on hopefully it didn't slip my mind here. The last speaker that spoke was
Scott.
Scott,
Yeah.
and he was representing
Green Terminal.
Green Terminal. Okay, there you go. Thank you. So, Green Terminal, I didn't hear anything about the vehicles of the employees and how that affects the emission and reducing that. And within the perimeter that he's talking about, is there a parking lot inside this facility that's possibly 200, and I could have these numbers wrong, 200 to 250 vehicles during the construction? And when it switches over from construction to employees, that's 250 vehicles, let's just say. Does that make an impact? And will they be looking at emission control on that? And suggestions to that is Being able to carpool and have buses, electric buses coming into the facility that eliminates them cars and that are putting out them emissions. And I think that should be in the report or in the study too, that these cars are emitting and they're waiting. And for if you guys lived in the Bay Area for anywhere in the city, they're going to work, but they're sitting 2 hours in traffic. I'm not saying we're going to be 2 hours in traffic, but there is going to be traffic and cars piled up before they get into the facility. And that's it.
Thank you. Just step up to the mic.
I'm just using the restroom, so I'm not just walking.
Any other comments? Yeah.
Scott Frazier, Blue Lake. I want to commend Commissioner Craig Benson for your questions, because you get to ask them, even though we don't. But I'm going to start my comments with a question that I'd be happy to have Chris call me later in the week with an answer next week. So are these three reports simply status updates on existing contracts, or is there some nexus to agenda item 11B and the $15.2 million in something you're expected to approve tonight? Because we're very interested in that. But one of your questions, Commissioner Benson, was about the information presented and yet some details that might not have been addressed. I think that these presentations did an excellent job on the engineering and some of the planning, but very little discussion that affects environmental concerns that many of us will hold dear when your document comes out. I understand you're going to consider an NOP sometime soon. So I think seeing just the engineering and planning side of this by itself tonight is not very helpful to the broader view that most of us have of these projects. I also find it interesting that the electric and hydrogen powered vehicles, crawler cranes, for example, are entirely hypothetical and probably not available until 2030. Maybe your project's not ready for prime time. Maybe it's really not ready till 2030. And that takes me to an aside, which is I believe a lot of your work on this project is a facility for no project, because as we know, the funding you had initially in the federal government has been withdrawn. And although you hope to get that replaced by state government, that is not realistic. I think you're planning a project that has no end user. And so you really ought to take that into account when you're asking for hundreds of millions of dollars from the state of California. I appreciated the last presenter, Scott, when he mentioned that some of the icons weren't something you could see. Well, from the seats over here, although we could see your staff's computer screen better than the large screen up here, it's difficult to see the presentations that were made. Plus, some of the print size was inappropriate for a mass audience in a room this size. It simply was not possible to read them. And my hearing's not great anyway. So I think you will need to continue with your questions, commissioners, and help those of us that want to see whether this project is economically viable or not. And I'll close with something that the previous executive director said on the Lost Coast Outpost, when he was asked, well, what if wind energy doesn't come? And Mr. Oker said, well, that doesn't matter. We'll find something else to do with it. Because I think there's a large risk of building a boondoggle that you don't have a use for.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Tina Manis. I live here in Humboldt, specifically in Samoa. And I was anxious to see the presentations this evening. Obviously, there's a lot of good things. And then there's a lot of concerns that those of us that live in Samoa have about even some of the things that were presented this evening. I'm thrilled that there's things like the Dark Skies Initiative, that there's a green terminal. But I'm really scared of the dredging, just from a personal point of view, just trying to imagine the noise, which is going to be the focus of my 2 minutes and 31 seconds that are left. My point is mostly here, and in subsequent meetings, I'm hoping to make the point that I started at the last meeting, and that is that I'm really interested in very candid, honest conversations. I'm interested in accurate and complete data, visuals, simulations, full disclosures, And I think it's important not only for the public, but those of you who will be making votes on what will happen in this community for the next, you know, 3-4 decades. I really want to focus today on a topic that was brought up at a previous meeting, and that is I want to look at the noise issue and the studies that were done and the report that we all received. The Samoa Steering Committee, as well as this group here, had a chance to hear the sound expert come in, and there are a lot of concerns that I have about the subsequent report that I was able to obtain. It all is important that we look at the community that's going to be impacted here. And I want to build on what Rod said, not only from a personal point of view, but I really hope that everyone in this room recognizes that there's already a disproportionate burden from lead exposure, asthma, cardiovascular disease, and poverty in the Samoa community in the peninsula. With regard to noise, I have some serious concerns about the report that we were given and the history of how this has unfolded from a community member who has been interested in the topic. We know that noise is the number one concern for residents. We know from the public meetings, we know that the Harbor District in 2023 came up with a port overlay proposal to the Planning Commission, essentially saying, here are the noise industrial standards that are current. Here's what is unlikely to happen, or we're not going to be able to adhere to this. So there's been an acknowledgement that these noise levels won't be what is recommended for human safety in terms of decibel levels. I can go in, but I have 26 seconds here on a number of different aspects. If you look carefully at that noise report that we were given, it's flawed in many ways. It uses decibel DBAs as the sole measure when there are things about tonality, intermittent variation of noise, which are more important to look at if you're interested in the sensitivity that humans have. Most importantly, I went back and I looked at the dates that the measures and the monitoring that was done in Samoa, and 3 days. 3 days doesn't influence weekends. So when I've been sitting in meetings for a year and a half and here, we don't know if this is going to be 24/7 operation, how can you even get a baseline measure that doesn't include the quieter times in our community? To me, you need to go back, redo that sound study. You need to look at tonality. You need to look at hum. You need to look at intermittent noise. You need to take measures for 7 days. You need to consider the weather conditions, and you need to look at adequate monitoring into the depth of the communities that you evaluated. Anybody that's interested in the technical pieces or the fine points here, I'm happy to answer those questions later, but it's important.
Todd Van Herp, Humboldt Bay Oyster Company, Eureka, District 4. I want to go back and commend the district on selecting a natural resources coordinator. Really glad that that came to pass and restore a balance, a sense of balance to development and a focus on natural resources. Hopefully that will grow into a directorship that adds value to this commission. I appreciate the reports on the heavy lift terminal. It's nice to see the green port addressed, and I'd like to I see that the advisory committee for that green terminal has met twice. I'm wondering when the next meeting might occur. A lot of my statements are going to come in as questions. I can follow up with anyone that would like to answer them. Next would be, I appreciated David's report on dark skies. Wondering what current ordinances will need to be modified to accommodate this project, and if there will be a comparison on current light versus impacts from the project. Next, John's on the dredging was enlightening. Glad to see some coverage of that. I'd liked some answers regarding the south slope versus north slope, what the difference is there. he noticed, he referenced that south is different from north and that clamshell dredge would be used on that location. He also mentioned that clamshell dredges are specifically used in areas that have sensitive material in the sediments. Would like to know what those sensitive materials are. Of course, as shellfish growers in the bay and as environmental stewards, we're concerned with dioxins, previous uses of that site as a lumber mill, and the use of pentachlorophenol at that location. We assume that there are contaminants in the soil and the sediments, the upland sediments, the sediments that will be dredged. And we'd like to, the project manager for this at Moffitt and Nickel mentioned that there are dioxins to be concerned with, also mentioned mercury, but stated that the level of mercury wasn't going to be a threat to human health. So just a little clarification. I appreciate it. That this was very enlightening. Appreciate the presentations. Thanks.
Sebastian Elright with Humboldt Bay Provisions, Aqua Rodeo Farms, and Humboldt Bay Oyster Tours. My comments will target or hit all three areas. For the dark skies, I'm kind of curious how well the dark skies certification accounts for bird flyways and some of those kind of things, as far as what kind of disturbance that might be for some of the pelicans or the cormorants or some of those other things that fly right through this area quite frequently. And then also I was interested in the dredging portion. They haven't really heard much about potential effects to the federal channel with the deep water dredging portion being lower than the federal channel and potential sloughing of the federal channel into that deep water portion, and what kind of circumstances that might present in the 408 permit process. And then also my comment on the green terminal portion, there wasn't really any mention of the potential for the batch cement plants that might be used to help do the pontoons and what kind of effect that might have on a carbon assessment. Thank you.
Any other comments from the House?
You guys laughed at me last month, but can I speak for my wife?
Right. It has to be. Yeah.
I've got one online.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead online. We have you, Sylvia.
Hello, can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, hi, I'm Sylvia with Humboldt Waterkeeper, for maybe the consultants in the room that aren't familiar with me and Humboldt Waterkeeper. We are super excited to hear that the Harbor District is going to be pursuing dark sky certification for the port while their port certification program is new. Their sports light certification is not new. And actually the tennis court that hosted the U.S. Tennis Open last year was dark sky certified. So it still will be safe and secure, and you will be able to see all the things. I know that the consultants aren't allowed to answer questions, but I'm going to ask them anyways and hope that they're answered later on. Regarding dredging, I would love to hear more about contaminated sediment management and also what the options are for mitigation around contaminated sediment, you know, what those avoidance and minimization measures are as well. I'm also really curious to hear more mitigation and best practice options for managing turbidity caused by dredging. And I was also a little puzzled by the use of the term environmentally sensitive materials. Would love to know what precisely that was referring to. And if it turns out that the sediments to be dredged are contaminated, how is that going to affect the plan, the dredging plan that we were presented today? Thank you.
Uh, Right. I think that concludes the public.
Sorry, there was one more public commenter waiting to give comment. Thank you. Good evening, folks. My name is Matt Simmons. I'm an attorney with the Environmental Protection Information Center. I want to thank all the consultants for their presentations. They were extremely helpful, as always. I do have one sort of comment about the green terminal strategy. While I understand why the Harbor District is not looking at emissions from sort of indirect sources associated with the terminal, so, you know, ships out at sea and trucks on the road, for purposes of CEQA, those sort of indirect emissions are typically considered under greenhouse gas analysis. And so I would encourage the Harbor District and Moffitt and Nickel to be thinking about potential ways to reduce those emissions, even if they are not specifically part of this document, the Green Terminal Strategy, just because, you know, they will be considered under a different document that the Harbor District is preparing, the Environmental Impact Report. Thank you again, and yeah.
Go ahead. Hi there, Amy Jester with the Core Hub, and I'm also a resident of South Eureka. And thanks so much again for the presentations tonight, and then just the series and creating space and time in each of your board meetings to do this deep dive. Dive into some of the technical aspects of the project. Related to the Green Terminal Roadmap, one of the things that I think about in that 10-11 year time span that's really being analyzed to get to that zero emission or better than zero or close to zero emission goal is what the cost might be. So getting operational and then continuing to get closer to near or zero emissions as the project has been operational for some time will require some level of additional beyond the initial infrastructure equipment that is brought online to get the project going. So it's just one of those things that I think about what level of barrier will it actually be to reaching those really important goals down the road if we're not able to afford that transition to a new crane, for example, once it's electrified, or the transition to the new infrastructure that's needed to actually power the crane down the road. So just thinking about the kind of risk related to cost some years into operations to actually getting there. Thanks.
Have I missed anybody who wants to comment? Okay. Given the time, I'm not going to go back to the consultants and re-ask all these questions of the consultants because we have other things on the agenda tonight. But for all who commented, your questions are noted, and the consultants have been listening to them. And so I personally, my message to the consultants is, you know what our community is interested in knowing, or at least a subsection of our community. And, you know, be prepared next time you get an opportunity to address these kinds of questions in your presentations, to the degree that it's within your scope. And there's a lot, you know, I'm not just giving you the green light to take on other studies, but to the degree possible, let's answer these public questions. All right, let us now move on to item 11, new business, to accept the audit report for field year 2024 and 2025 fiscal year.
I like to think we saved the best for last, but I am the only accountant in the room. My name is Lindsay Grossman. I'm the treasurer of the district, owner of a small accounting firm in Eureka, Grossman Haig. And the audit is a collaborative effort. Mindy does a ton of the heavy lifting, you know, internally, and then we're kind of the liaison with the external auditor, Harshwell. And I won't go into all the details. It was a 49-page report. It's in the board packet if anybody wants to take a further dive. This year, we're proud that it was an unmodified opinion, which means it's a clean audit. There was no compliance issues, no findings, that sort of thing. So I know Mindy and I always take a lot of pride in that because it is a lot of work to get through the process. A couple of things that were different this year that I wanted to note was there was the implementation of a new government accounting standard board 101, which it was implemented in 2025, but they actually had to go back to 24 and also implement it back to that year as well. So that was basically accounting for how they're accruing sick pay, even if it's not payable at that moment in time. So it was about $49,000 difference. That was just a standard implementation, nothing weird or crazy there. And then the other big piece was we've started now putting in the work in progress for the heavy lift marine terminal. So that was $3.6 million that we're showing as an other asset as the years go and we continue to grow this until it's placed in service, it will sit there. So those are some of the bigger, you know, differences from prior years. And I do on page 35, there is more information on the GASB 31 if you guys wanted to look into that. And this was just a quick glance at some of the changes. So, and again, this is the 24-25 audit that I'm talking about. We're always living in the past, unfortunately, but this is comparing the fiscal year 25 to 24. Operating revenue went down. I know there was some decreases in the rents there. Then the operating expenses do show that they increased, but that also includes depreciation expense, which is annualizing a portion of a fixed asset over several years. So those were kind of different caveats that I wanted to touch on because, you know, sometimes it's hard to show the whole picture in a couple of slides. Here it does show the net position overall did increase almost $1 million, but again, that does come into play with transferring over that work in progress for the marine terminal project. And the last slide, this was kind of looking at the balance sheet and looking at the assets versus liabilities. The cash was at $1.9 million at the end of the year, was down from the prior year. A lot of that has to do with the timing issues with some of the big grant expenses and some of the different types of the grant income, whether or not it's reimbursable or if we're able to hold those funds in advance. The notes that we have were down over $1 million. So, you know, they at the end of the year we're at the 6.7 million. So that is definitely going in the right direction. No new loans or anything. And the capital assets net of depreciation were at the 21.5. And I did have dredging costs were also capitalized in the year for $2 million. I think that's all I got. I'm happy to answer questions or go into deeper, but I know it might not be the most exciting thing for you guys.
I don't have any questions. I noticed there's one note, but we could talk about that later about the dredging ballots or dredge surcharge, and but that's a planning thing for this year.
Okay.
Stephen, do you have any questions?
I have no auditor's questions. Report? No, thank you. Thank you for that report, though.
Being part of the finance committee, I've gotten to interact with you more about all the financial reports that led to this independent auditor's report. And with auditor's report, I mean, a good audit is, you know, no news is good news, kind of, you right. know, kind of a thing. So, and a lot of work went into it, and I appreciate it. And I we need to make a motion to accept this, Ryan.
Yeah, okay. I'll make a motion to accept the revenue audit.
Okay, so Jack makes a motion to accept the audit report.
I'll second.
And sounds like Mr. Coleman seconds it, so we can put it to a vote. I don't think there's any public. Oh, sorry. Yep. Thank you. Keeping me straight here. Public comment on the audit report.
Justin,
this thing.
Yeah.
Sounds like
you've got to step up to the mic.
Stands up, Joe.
Thank you, Rod. Yeah.
It looks like we might have some money in the budget to put me on the payroll. So I'm waiting for a position at some point. And so anyway, just that's my comment.
Okay. Okay. Any other public comment? Anyone online? Okay. Ready to vote.
Okay. Commissioner Benson.
Yes.
Commissioner Coleman.
Yes.
Commissioner Morton.
Yes.
AL and Newman absent.
Okay. The motion carries, and let's move to 11B. Authorize the executive director to negotiate and execute a contract with Moffitt and Nickel for continued the expanding planning, permitting, and design services funded by the California Energy Commission, a waterfront facility improvement program, OSW 25. Will we be hearing a report on this?
I do believe we have someone on the phone or on the online here with us, either Shelley or Shane from Moffitt Nickel, who may want to add something, but I'm not 100% certain.
Okay.
So it's important to know that the commission previously authorized staff to submit a grant application to the California Energy Commission under the Waterfront Facility Improvement Program, now known as OSW 25. And in that program, there was a scope of work, a number of tasks issued, and we were to be a recipient within a subrecipient and those subcontractors or vendors underneath that. It's kind of the format of this grant. So at the time of application, the Harbor District applied, of course, as the recipient, and we had a total successful award of $18,250,000 for the work placed in the grant. It was slightly less than what we applied for, and we cooperated on that adjustment. So awards were consistent with other ports. Moffitt Nickel, who was the applicant with us as a subrecipient, received $15,267,000 of that amount contracted through us, the recipient. So the purpose of what we're doing here tonight is to set that process active. It's important to note that Moffitt Nickel will subcontract supporting technical studies and field surveys. So not all of the work is performed just by Moffitt. They will be bringing others into the project with them. Again, work, as I put it in the staff report, work authorized under the contract will be periodic by task and scope. I have an example of that here, and is not authorized in whole or as a lump sum. So while we need the fluidness to be able to commence these tasks as they occur, and our practices bring the entire process forward up front, I do want everybody to understand we are not issuing Moffitt Nickel a purchase order tomorrow or the following day for $15,216,267.
Good thing.
Rather, you're authorizing us to commence the activities as part of this grant as awarded, and we'll be issuing those by task and scope moving forward. And I'm sorry, this is a little small. It was giant on my screen, and I try to get these sizes correctly. What I'm showing here in pink is the subrecipient vendor awards. And so you'll see it's a bit more than the $15 million that Moffitt's receiving at $16,671,273. There are two other folks that will be awarded under this, both as separate issues. And that has to do with community engagement strategy and capacity building. But the grand total of the grant, again, was $18,250,000 that we received as a recipient. And Moffitt Nickel, we would be awarding to them as awarded underneath the grant, a contract, remember it flows to the recipient, for $15,216,267. They conduct certain work, and I'll get to that in just a second. So this is what one of our task order looks like. This is the one that we executed most recently under OSW 21.
So it clearly states what we're working on, the specific tasks that are itemized within the grant themselves as the, as deliverables, what they would include. Oops, excuse me. I'm missing a page here. Somehow got out of order. What the deliverables are, anything we need to know, any exceptions, final deliverables. It's agreed to by the vendor as well as the district, and then there's a supporting budget request that goes with it, and we know what our drawdown schedule is accordingly. So this gives you a little bit of a view of what that's like. That is also executed by both parties, so there's no dispute over the cost of each one of those tasks. This is the summary of tasks to be delivered underneath those activities. It's a pretty detailed list. These also directly relate to the grant itself and the categories within there. Included in your staff report, I did not put it in the presentation because it's very large, is the actual scope of work for the grant as well as the awards. Keep in mind, this is identically consistent with what we originally applied for with the grant. If there's any modification necessary, that's taken in the future when that is identified. And it takes not only a contract amendment, but it takes a grant amendment as well. So what we're simply doing here is looking for the ability to go ahead and commence the activities under OSW 25. Whoops, going the wrong direction. As originally awarded. Happy to take questions. And again, I don't know if Shelley is on. I know either her or Shane were gonna attend. Not asking them to speak, but if they had anything they wanted to include, I wanted to give them that opportunity. Shelly does have her hand up.
Let's have Shelly speak then. Yeah. Shelly, go ahead.
All right, thank you. I just wanted to let you know that I am available for questions and any questions about the contract and our discussions with the district. That's it.
Thank you. I'll turn it to the commission. Are there questions on either the tasks, the contract, any other part of that, the motion that's on that we're going to make? Stephen, do you have any questions or
Nothing
comments?
for me.
I just have one question. I mean, it seemed I looked at some of the tasks, and so if there was a scope of work, and if you feel comfortable, Chris, that if you had to ask Moffitt and Nicole to expand a little bit, it says, I mean, we might agree that it's, something that is the task is, I don't know, for example, let's say, what we want you to paint the wall blue, and it's a different shade of blue, and the community says, hey, look, we want to have more information regarding reflection of light or what have you. So, I think the scope of work is what I saw was kind of broad or kind of vague. It's not really descriptive as in exact details or in limitations, if there is limitations. So do you feel comfortable that with working with Moffitt and Nickel, that if you came back and said, hey, we need some more information regarding one of the tasks that we agreed upon that we were going to work on or have them do, that they were going to still, go that extra mile or go that extra bit. I know that there are some parameters where we do say, and I think what some of the limitations I've heard tonight was like greenhouse gas. And, I think that Rob is kind of been pretty adamant in the scope is, hey, this is just the terminal. We're not talking about the what extension of the line, the power lines going off site, or vehicles, even such as vehicles coming onto site will address some of that. And I think even from the Green Terminal Advisory Committee, we talked a little bit about buses and trying to mitigate some of that. So there's a balance between the scope of this project, but then there are we realize it that has other broadening impacts. And I was wondering if that we feel comfortable as a district that those concerns are still going to be addressed.
So I want to ask a couple of questions just to make sure I was being a good listener. I heard you. I heard two questions. One is our comfort level with Moffitt-Nichol and their willingness and ability to maybe go outside the lines a little bit to get us really accurate data. And sometimes we have to go above and beyond in order to get answers to questions or expand our studies a little bit.
Correct, yeah.
The other question I think I heard you say is, what happens when it's not enough? Well, that's what this grant is all about. Reading directly from the staff report, ongoing agency, tribal, community, and interested party engagement has identified the need for additional environmental and technical studies. The whole process through community engagement, it's a learning process for everybody, including our consultants. They aren't always able to say, yes, we can hit that. Sometimes we have to say, that's not a CEQA item. We only have that in CEQA, but we have money over here in our community engagement strategy. What can we do? Who can we find? Who can we connect with? Or is this something we can expand in a study? The bulk of the studies in WFIP go far past CEQA. This goes into the greater permitting process. Some of the questions that were raised tonight, we hope to be able to identify those through these expanded studies. It's important to understand that we're, I hate to use the term, closing a set of studies, but we are coming to a certain point in a CEQA document that moves stuff forward, and that gives an uncomfortable feeling. But yet we're going further here. There is a current request that's out there. It's an administrative request at this point in time that would allow us maybe to expand these studies and take that final document a bit further. We're not there yet. We can't have an open dialogue on it yet. But I believe that effort is being made. I think it's being made in diligence. It doesn't always feel that way when the reports come back, and that's why we're presenting the reports, is to gain the feedback, bring them in draft format, and come back. To date, there hasn't been a lot of disappointment there in terms of what the vendors brought back. Are all these studies done today that we can provide that testimony? We don't have concrete evidence at every turn. But what we know we're working on with the vendors, the diligence to get that done is there.
Great.
Future delivery, proof's in the pudding, I think is how they say it.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, for me, I mean, this was 135 pages of reading. Thank you.
Oh, we left quite a few out.
I know, and a
But
30
we put
page
everything substantive, of course, in the staff
and a 30 page scope of work. And what I appreciate about the scope of work is that it's task and subtask and deliverables. I mean, it's really clear what the Harbor District is going to get out of it. I also it's important to me that there's also flexibility in this document so that as we hear community concerns, we have a lot of smart community folk out there who are daylighting issues that maybe we haven't delved far enough into, so that we it's important to me that the community sees that questions that come up in forums like this or the community advisory committee, et cetera, that they could look through this scope of work and say, oh, that's going to be addressed under that task. So as we can continue to incorporate and ensure that concerns that the community have and questions are addressed in the scope of work, we want to authorize you to move forward. I have every confidence in Moffitt and Nichol, but I also want to be able to see that community input is actually translating into scope where it's reasonable. I mean, we're not going to create a scope just to answer every community question that's out there, but those that are really that we hear over and over again that are really important. So I think we have to make a motion here to
Remember, task just as a point here, task two, three, and four are about just that. And that clearly affects the other tasks in there. But I think it is important that we acknowledge some of the key initiatives of this, which is engagement, tribal participation, greater community engagement, and then, or excuse me, community participation, and finding ways to cause people to be able to participate who haven't yet.
Yeah, got it.
Well, I make a motion to authorize the executive director to negotiate and execute the contract with Moffitt-Nichol in the amount of $15,216,267.
I second the motion. Let's take it to community comments. Any community comment on this item? Anyone online? Okay. $15 million plus. I guess we're ready for
Commissioner. Well, oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Off the, Commissioner Coleman?
Yes.
Commissioner Benson?
Yes.
Commissioner Norton?
Yes.
Dale and Newman absent.
That's the last item. I want to thank everyone for coming, our consultants, especially the public and staff. Meeting is adjourned.